Yesterday is only a memory, and this is a completely new moment. The span of this day is our opportunity to practice meditation following the instructions of the Buddha, or the wise one, that which is wise. In other words, to, at this time in the morning, to incline one's mind toward being alert, reflecting, that this is an opportunity, is use this daytime span in a way that is skillful, both for your own happiness and peace of mind, and also for the welfare of other beings. When we reflect in this way, it's the way of what we call recollection. We have very good memories. Human beings, you see, we have these retentive memories. We retain in through symbols. We remember past incidences. We can learn languages because we have this ability to learn symbols. Remember symbols and use them. And they also remember what we do and say. So, like if you note in your, when you remember things from your past, it's usually something extreme. Some great happiness or great success or some great humiliation. Some terrible incident or miserable experience. Who remembers what one ate 10 years ago at this time in the morning? Unless it was poisoned food, ambrosia from the deva realms. So the ordinary things we don't remember, but we do remember the big things, like big moments, the great romance, feeling of wanting to kill somebody, the great passions, very strong conditions from our past, we remember, but we also forget them, and then we remember them again. So it's very important for us to, when we recognize this, then you have to remember that if you do anything wrong, you're going to have to remember it again, where we feel guilty and remorseful. One time, a young lady came to me. She was all very upset by something. And she says, "Oh, Ajahn Sumedho, I've done something terrible." And I just said, "Well, it's only a memory now. Don't make anything out of it." So she went away and came back. She said, "Oh, Ajahn Sumedho, I can't live with myself. It's so terrible. I just keep reflecting on this." Finally, she came back again, and I realized that she really wanted to tell me what she thought. I said, "Okay, tell me what you've done." And she had an abortion. And she says, "I'm so frightened. What will happen to me? What kind of terrible fate awaits me for having done this? What is the karmic result?" I said, "Right now, what's going on? Are you happy? Is it a happy memory? Does it bring you joy when you reflect on it? Does it make you feel certain that when you die you're going to be born as an angel in the heavenly realm? Do you feel, what is it? And just look and observe. This is the karmic result of such action. And you just observe the karmic result now, you see it. Because all these things are leave their impression on our mind. They remember them." And she was worried, oh, sometime in the future, what's going to happen to me? What dreadful thing can happen? What can be more dreadful than being miserable right now, full of guilt and fear? So that when we remember this, when we recollect that what we do, if we can remember it, then we're more careful about what we do, what we say. But there's no point in building up a lot of unpleasant memories for us to remember. I mean, when we see how it works, then we're more careful, aren't we? We naturally live our lives more carefully, more responsibly, than just habitually or indulgently. So, but because we forget and we get carried away with our passions, things like morning chanting or at least morning recollection is helpful, reminds us, sets the tone for the day. And if you wake up in the morning heedlessly, and the alarm clock rings and you, oh, damn clock, another day, to go to the office, to face all those people I can't stand, do this, do that. And you get up in this kind of negative attitude and have a cigarette, drink a cup of coffee, and stumble around, trip over the couch, fall flat on your backside on the floor, curse a few times, and put on your clothes and go out to work. That's the tone for the day. Oh, those awful people, I hate them, can't stand the boss, the secretary, the manager, the assistant, the clerk, an awful, disgusting elevator operator. So when you go inside the elevator, hope he doesn't tell one of those corny jokes again. I couldn't stand it this morning. They carry this kind of negative feeling with you. Of influences. Somebody, the clerk says, good morning, wonderful day. And they say, oh, shut up. Now, how we go to bed also has its effect on us. So that if we, time to go to bed, and you crash down and think, to hell with the whole world, I'm just going to annihilate myself, and crash, off you go. Then you wake up heedlessly and stumble around, curse and swear, hate everybody, and so forth. You're just creating a whole pattern of negativity to remember and condition the mind with. The mind will just become conditioned in that way, in those patterns. Now, if we can also say, well, then should I just wake up and say, goody, goody, everything's wonderful, and kind of be kind of like Pollyanna. But that's not being honest either. I think it's a way to fall asleep mindfully, to make these attempts to be very aware of what we're doing, really scrutinize these very kind of seemingly insignificant details of our daily life. Not to analyze, like I've been saying, but to have this knowing, to fall asleep knowingly rather than just habitually. Then to wake up, and don't think you have to feel goody-goody, and say, oh, another wonderful day to challenge the world, perfect my practice. If you really feel pretty dreadful and down, you're not trying to lie to yourself, but just observe this. Just observe in an alert and friendly way, calm way, with metta, the the way things are now, like the feeling, maybe it's just feeling hazy or negative or positive or whatever the condition might be. Usually waking up is not something generally that one likes to do. And especially in the winter time and the cold, you don't, in England, in America where they have central heating, you're kind of dried out the problem, but in England, they don't, like Chitthurst House is nice and damp and cold in the morning. And you're laying there in your bed, all nice and warm. Just sensually, it's an unpleasant experience to get out of that nice warm bed. Who wants to go out into the cold? And you just want to curl up under the blankets and stay there, not have to go out into the cold. It takes some kind of positive effort on our part to make that movement, to experience, say, the cold feeling. If we think about it, we can't do it. We have to just do it. Like taking cold showers. If you think about taking cold showers, you'll never do it, unless it's hot. If it's very hot, then cold showers sounds nice. But if it's cold, the idea of taking a cold shower is something you just, if you think about, you will never do it. It's something you have to do. So, using a daytime span, say when you wake up in the morning, reflecting on it, alert to the condition of the way the conditions are as you're experiencing them. Just pay attention. But don't indulge in negativity, but know that negativity's there. If you're going to indulge, then indulge in more positive conditions, like movement, getting up, standing up straight, doing a few exercises, bowing, chanting, doing something that you have to do it rather than just kind of sit around being very passive and negative, because at that time we need to put forth more effort. The body's, from its sleep state, is in a very passive physical condition. And from having slept for those hours during the night, tends to be passive. So we need at that time to put more effort into just getting up, doing things, into our mental processes, such as, say, using the chanting or the reflections on Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Wonder where all these people are that didn't come this morning. You see, they'd rather passively lay there than put forth the effort in getting up, because it takes effort. Then the opportunity, like in, say, a monastic form, it's not just up to oneself. One has the kind of conditions around one to help a lot, like the bell ringing at 4 a.m, or the expectation that everybody's supposed to get up at 4 a.m. unless you're sick, so that you do that. The meetings and chanting and all that is, very supportive. If one's left on one's own, one tends to follow, unless one is quite, has a lot of self-motivation. But if one tends to indulge and believe in one's feelings at the moment, then one might be able to get up a few times in the morning and early, then the rest of the time just follow the desire to be comfortable. So you have to find ways of motivating ourselves, of just like aditana or resolution, making a resolution like for a week or 2 weeks or a month, really developing resolution, like on this retreat here is only 8-day retreat. How many, you know, to resolve to get up at 4 in the morning for these 8 days, unless there's serious illness, is a way of developing practice, not just following, I don't want to go to that morning chanting, I don't see the point of it, I don't want to be bothered with it, it's more important for me to get some rest than to do that. Believing all that kind of silliness. People believe all that. I really need my rest. Falling apart. Anyway, some of the monks practice the sitter's practice. This is an ascetic practice the Buddha allowed, in which you don't ever lay down. Now there, sometimes you really fall apart. You're sitting there. The first month of this sitter's practice, all you're doing is falling apart for a month. Your mind just goes every which way, and you're just in the body and everything. It's just most unpleasant for nearly a whole month. You're just going crazy. You just see the mind just falling apart, and all the kind of fears and worries and negativity, annoyance and dullness, and just sitting there like this and going, till you get the hang of it. And that takes a real adhitana resolution to be able to do something like that. Because your desires certainly don't want to do that, certainly. I need my rest, I'm going to lose my health, I'm going to go crazy, oh no. You believe it, you know. Start believing it. Believing all the worries, all the rationalizations of your intelligent mind. It all just sounds so terribly intelligent, you think it's wisdom. Well, after all, we do need so many hours of sleep. I mean, I can't sleep sitting up, I need to lie down to do that. Falling apart, and you listen to that, you believe it. Or you get a letter from your mother, and she says, "Dear, be sure and get 8 hours sleep a night." Okay, well, mother knows best. But that's only a voluntary practice, not one that everyone needs to do or will do. But it's an example of that it's even all right to fall apart and to have that feeling of just going to pieces. It's also a kind of purification to see that, see what the mind does when you don't have all the familiar things and crutches and supports that kind of make you feel that you're together. People get into these kind of very ritualistic patterns of behavior just to feel that they're together. And when they don't get enough sleep or enough to eat or things change and go off, we feel very, very like I'm going to fall apart, I'll go crazy, I won't know how to deal with it. So we have to make sure that everything is like this, ordered, definite. Then we feel, as long as these 4 pillars are here, I'll feel safe. My strength is dependent upon everything being just so. When something goes a little bit off, ooh, frightens me, I don't know how to deal with it. But like I've been saying, it's even the irrational is only a condition changing and not self. The feeling of falling apart is just a condition changing. And you can watch that feeling and see, who is it that watches, that knows that there's the feeling of one falling apart? Well, just to say, you don't have to go down, just develop for adhitana, for resolution, develop a lifestyle that is within the spirit of the way you're living and your profession, the people you're living with, so you're not, being like a monk's life, our lifestyle. We can afford to do things like that because we can be crotchety or dull and work and watch and learn through that. But if you're on a building site, crawling up high on high-rise buildings, skyscrapers and that, and you're falling asleep, it's you have to consider the conditions, the things you have to do. So you have to use your wisdom. But to develop a pattern or a way of living that is, say, that is using more effort rather than just following habit, waking up habit, in which you have to apply effort and rather than just rely on the momentum of the things around you to carry you along. Our reflections on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is as people sometimes feel, they come to Buddhism through, say, intellectual interest in the teaching, or they come to Buddhism through taking meditation retreat, even though they know nothing about Buddha Dhamma Sangha. It doesn't mean anything to them. The word Buddha doesn't mean anything. Just you understand what it is, but it doesn't reach you in any way, other than you may like it or respect it a bit. There's many Buddhists I've known, when they get really emotionally upset, they turn to Jesus. So, and Jesus is something like when you're a child, you have a relationship with Jesus sometimes. And you feel when you're really frightened and worried and upset, and Jesus, help me. And here you've been practicing vipassana and sitting here watching impermanency. And then some really frightening thing happens in your life. You're very upset and you can't just sit there and watch impermanency. Is emotionally too distraught. So, Jesus, please. Which is all right. Nothing wrong with that. But observe this, how we seek when life really gets difficult. Protection, and it's something you can't just sit and watch. If you're really upset about something, and you can't get a perspective on it sometimes. You need a devotion. You need a surrendering devotion, a plea, a request for help. That in us, that feeling of devotion is also part of our life, of love and devotion, the emotional side, the devotional side. So that's why to Buddhists there's no problem, like in Thailand, when Thai people get upset and life becomes very difficult, they don't turn to Jesus. Unless they're Christians, they turn to a Buddha or to the Bhikkhu Sangha or something. They start going or taking offerings to the temple and bowing to the Buddha Rupa listening to, start going to seek a wise teacher to have them to find out more, or to give them some help and solace. So, like temples in Thailand, you see people going, like at Wat Bapong. One time, a man in Warin, in the town, large town near Wat Bapong, he was a Chinese merchant, and he had a pharmacy, and it burned down. Everything was lost. Everything, all his money and possessions, completely burned to the ground. And he was I'd seen him periodically. He'd come to Wat Pa Pong sometimes, but more or less, you know, just he was a very worldly man and interested in making money and just coming to the Wat or the temple probably just to make merit so he could make more money. But then after this, he was so shocked, he couldn't function anymore. So they brought him out to the temple, to the Wat Pa Pong, and he just kind of sit there with Ajahn Chah for several weeks. He just sit there under Ajahn Chah's kuti. Ajahn Chah would be come down, and this man would just be kind of like this. He'd touch him, and he'd kind of try to smile or try to communicate, but he was just in a state of shock. But he couldn't go back, and he had no place to go in the town, and the only kind of solace was coming from his faith in the with Ajahn Chah. But after a few weeks, Ajahn Chah took time to kind of get him to look at it, what had happened and his reaction, and see the suffering of attachment. And so he turned something that was tragic into something that was Dharma, a way of learning that helped the man very much. Probably it was a blessing in disguise, the fire. Because he was one of these Chinese merchants who just lived for making money. After that, he had a much profounder and deeper understanding of his life and how to live. Now, Buddha for me, didn't mean anything either. I certainly respected his teaching, and Gautama Buddha seemed to be someone of worthy of respect indeed, but it didn't reach, and it hadn't developed as a devotion, except through the practice of meditation and through reflection. So that's why, when suddenly I realized what a really great teacher Gautama the Buddha was, that he could establish such a teaching in such a distant time that still is so very good and precise and clear and useful for people here. To me, it's quite a miraculous thing. Things like this, you tend to feel, a sense of gratitude arises. It's like, think of the teachers who've taught you, who've shared their Dharma experience with you. You know, and helped you to look at yourself and the world you're living in a different way that is more skillful and has helped you in dealing with problems that before seemed to overwhelm you. And you reflect on that, like sharing merit or praying or wishing the best or living a good life, not only for your own peace of mind and Dharma practice, but as a way of repaying your teachers too, because it would make the teachers very happy to know that they had what they had taught you, you had actually practiced and were living a life that was worthy of respect. When I hear that, when somebody tells me that they're living more carefully now because of the teaching that they heard from me, makes me very happy. Nice to hear. Whether they tell me or not, still doing it is the important thing. This is a way of, say, developing the devotion, that sense of, not blind devotion, it's kind of praying to unknown entities, or belief in ideas, but actually just reflecting and watching things, really examining what Buddha is, what the teacher has done, rather than, say, spending your time fault-finding with the teacher. All of us you can find plenty of faults with. There's not one teacher in the world that you can't find something wrong with if you've got a good critical faculty, highly developed. You can expect teachers to be perfect just for you also, but rather than, say, demand teachers be flawless and perfect so that your confidence will never be shaken in them, reflect on, even if teachers themselves are far from perfect and live lives that aren't all that admirable, still what they've taught you to be good, refrain from doing evil, to be mindful. This teaching of the Buddha is something that we, if we reflect on it, we'll feel gratitude, appreciation, sense of love arises. And that in itself is conducive to enlightenment. When this sense of gratitude, of joy, and of devotion is necessary for enlightenment. Just to sit here repressing everything, trying to get the mind so it doesn't move, you'll be reborn as a log or a stone. In the Buddhist cosmology, they talk about that. The arupajanas, if you die in the state of formlessness, no, is it one form, one level of fourth jhana, a satasanya level. If you die in that state, you have to live as a stone for eons of time. You just have form but no mentality functions. So you see, maybe all these stones around here are in fourth jhana. That's why the American Indians went so wrong in kind of bowing down to mountains and that. It takes quite tremendous skill to get into fourth jhana, satasanya. So reflect on the Buddha, the one who knows, that in here that knows, the knowing, being the knowing in you and the knowing in me is the same knowing, that's not Sumato knowing nor Roger knowing, it's just knowing. It's not nobody owns the knowing, it's not female knowing or male knowing. The same knowing, knowing that all that arises passes away, knowing that it's not self. The knowing is the where we merge. In the known is where we all separate. Like what I remember, the thoughts in my mind now are different than the thoughts in your mind, aren't they? The quality of them. I'm remembering Seattle, Washington. You're remembering Buffalo, New York. Or the feeling, the pain, or the, all these are infinitely various and different. So they're changing from one moment to the next. So the known is always changing. Various, but the knowing is the same for all of us. There's no knowing that has any personality or individuality. It's the knowing wisdom where we merge. When we fully know that, then we no longer have to regard each other as threats, objects, and that. you no longer regard such discriminations as race, class, sex, all this as being of anything worthy of giving any great place in our thoughts or as being reality. No longer important to carry that around as an identity. Because in the knowing, then how could I, if I hit you, it'd be like hitting myself, wouldn't it? Hurts too much. Why should I hit myself? I'd do that to you. Pointless, isn't it? Unless, you know, you're walking into the off the edge of a cliff and I have to kind of punch you to stop you from doing it. That's more compassion, like bashing oneself to wake one up, to make one more alert. But that's through wisdom, through compassion, not through seeing you or me as a being, as an individual, as a separate entity in time and space. These are in the knowing, merging in that knowing. We can learn to live with each other in these forms and conditions of samsara wisely and generously, compassionately. Go through the forms of that we find ourselves in and enjoy it. Life can be quite, somebody asked me, how do you feel about being an abbot of a monastery? What is your attitude about that? How do you personally feel about it? That's a lot of fun, really. If you realize it's not you, then you can play the game of abbot and have a really good time doing it. It has its pleasures. What do you think? Oh, I'm the abbot. Oh, you think, oh, what a pain in the neck being an abbot is. People come and complain and they do this and the monks don't practice like I want them to and things, and difficulties, and it becomes a heavy burden. Or you can become a conceited ass and the abbot of Chittur. You better show your respect to me. But when you realize it's only a condition changing and it's not self, then you can learn to play the game quite with some style and some vigor. It's all quite fun. But if you start taking these roles seriously, then life becomes really dreary. Well, you've got to, you know, the abbot is just, I've got to see that Sujito practices hard. Sujito, what time did you get up in the morning? You slept in. I've been trying to, that kind of motherly nagging thing, and the Jewish mother comes out. Work my fingers to the bone, slave. Nobody appreciates me. I saw this one time, even recently, this nagging mother thing comes up in one, and Chittur's house, we're trying to be very kind of live very simply and economically. So one morning I had to get up at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I went out of my room and the electricity in the hallway was still on. And this thing rose up and said, these people practicing mindfulness, they leave the electricity on all night. I'm wasting my time. I listen to this nagging mother started laughing. You see how easy it is to believe those things. You know, start believing that movement of the mind, and then in the morning go down and you start. I want these electricity turned off at 10 o'clock at night. No, no, no. Making it into a burden by believing all that. That's why this inner listening, inner listen to these things, these kind of movements, because they're accumulations of all the things we've heard in the past from our mothers and fathers, school teachers, friends, enemies, and so forth. They come up on it. These are the sanya. The sanya comes out, perceptions. But they're impermanent and not self. That doesn't mean we allow the people to just follow their desires. When you're training monks and that, you have to browbeat a bit and scold and look fierce. It's all part of the game. And they believe it at first, are intimidated until they start beginning to realize the impermanent nature of all conditions and not self. But that's what we mean. Like, after a while, when life no longer is a heavy burden, when you can see it as it really is, and the forms we find ourselves in, we can use, we can live within them. And even if, like in monastic form, it's a very nice form to live with, so that one experiences a lot of joy from it, a lot of happiness. But in the they sometimes our lives don't allow us to have forms, forms that are all that pleasant. But wisdom is learning how to use the forms that we find ourselves with skillfully. We don't need to be happy. That's not the goal of life, but mindful and compassionate. And then the joy is something else, is no other than happiness. Joy is a spontaneous arising when there's no self. Even though we may not find ourselves in conditions that bring happiness, that doesn't prevent joy. But that only comes through selfless action, rather than selfish action brings no joy at all. Handamayang utisanati tanakata yo bhanama se. O banjaya kunudaram ajariyo bhagharaja madabhirajayadaga yuriyo chandi maraja kunawanta narabhija. Voma maraja indha ja loka phala ja devanda yamo mitha manusa ja matadha virika vita sabhe sadha sukhi hontu punyani bhagantani me sukhang ja devithang tendu kibang bhaveta vomadang imina punya gammena imina utisena cha Chepahang surapai jewadan hubadhana chetanang Ye santhane hinadhamma yawani panato mamang Na sando sapandhaye vaya tachato pawe pawe Ucho chidang satipanya saliko viriyamina Marala pantu noga sangha duncha virye sume Bhūtāti pāpāro nātho dhammo nātho varantammo nātho bhajekā puttho jā sankho nātho dharo mamang deso dhamma nupāvena maroka sangla pandumā